Until one day, a senator gets up with all seriousness and says, for the good of mankind, we must create a clean H-bomb. This would have been totally incomprehensible to a man of 500 years ago. He would never have been so fooled as to say, for the good of mankind, we must create a giant battering ram that only batters in one direction. It doesn't keep kicking back on me. You'd never be fooled by that. But now, you know, we accept it and we understand what he means by this. That somehow it is for the good of mankind that we have a clean H-bomb. We shouldn't have any H-bomb at all, you see. That's the whole point. Nobody, anywhere. Because H-bombs are only for one thing. They ain't for digging harbors up in Alaska, I can tell you that. Oh, no siree, Bob Rooney. And I don't know how clean an H-bomb ever gets, but have you ever seen anybody hit by high explosive that has no fallout at all? It ain't very clean. Unless, of course, there is total ionization, which is very clean. It's exceedingly clean. And then the fallout you get, of course, is very harmless, really. It's just kind of a red mist. And it's really harmless. It has no lasting effects except to the soul of everyone who's involved. Not to the bone marrow, that's true, but oh boy. That's right, I mean, who? And so we live in interesting, wonderful times, and I'm glad to be alive, tremendously glad. And there hardly is a day goes by when I'm not walking along and looking up at the buildings. You know, you look up at the top of the buildings, believe me, watch. Walk up and down 6th Avenue, some 7th Avenue particularly, up in the 50s, and look up at the top of those buildings there, and you'll see the traces of Greek civilization. But up at the top of the buildings, yes, they have the Parthenon. They have these big Grecian columns and so on, way up at the top. The old nostalgia for things. But of course, you don't have any Grecian columns on the Lieberhaus now, you see. And that's gone. This is the beginning of the new world, you see. And as you ride on the L's, if you've ridden on the L's and you look out over the houses, look at the top of all the houses in the slum areas up around North and that. Look around, up in Harlem and that. You see these old buildings built around 1900 with the great big concrete grapes hanging down from the top and all the concrete Gothic gargoyles looking out. Even the Gothic world is still hanging on. It's all there, you know. It's all packed down hard and tight right here in the middle of it all. If you look around, you can see it. But our whole trail goes all the way back. And if you walk up and you look at Ziegfeld's Theater there up on 6th Avenue there in the 50s, and you look up, and there it is. The Egyptians are looking down on you now. This goes back 4,000 and some odd years, and still the traces remain everywhere. And I'm sure that 6,000 years from now, providing we develop a clean H-bomb, for the good of mankind. And 6,000 years from now, people will be looking up at the tops of buildings and they say, you know, you can see remnants of those ancient civilizations. Yeah, look at that. It's 20th century during the Hope period. Around 19, I'd say, I guess that style developed around 1945. Earlier, actually. It came out of Europe. The Bauhaus school, they used to call it. And they look up and they wonder, you know. And we'll, of course, be 6,000 years gone. And this is inevitable. I'll sit out there and say, this guy is talking out of them. No, no. 6,000 years will pass. And we will be gone. This is not conjecture. And if you think it's conjecture, man, you are caught so deep in the dream, there's no talking about it. And, you know, you walk around and you look and you see and you feel and you say to yourself, this is my time. This is my time. And I want to know as much about it as I can. I want to see as much of it as I can and feel and express and understand as much about it as I can. Because it's the only one I will ever have. that I will ever know. It's like a man walking through the Renaissance towns. You know, you go to Italy and you have the feeling of it. I guess this is one of the reasons why Europeans are more fatalistic than we are. Because as you walk around most towns in Europe, the past is alive. It is hanging over you. It is pushing at you. And yet they're all gone. And you're constantly reminded of that. They're all gone. There's not a single Renaissance man left in Cremona. Not one. There is not a single Gothic man left in Heidelberg. Not one. The only thing that's left are the few things they left behind them, made out of concrete and stone and iron and so on. And they are gone. And yet they still linger on, you know, in a strange way. They linger on in our memories. They linger on in all sorts of ways. When you look out over the Harlem rooftops and you see it, you see the Parthenon, of all things, on 125th Street. Right there. You see all the pantheon of all the gods spread out before you. Of all the forgotten gods, yet, but nobody wants to really take a chance, you know. Nobody's quite sure about Mercury, or Apollo, or Zeus, or any of the others. And in our own way, we still pay obeisance to them. In different ways, of course. Look around and you'll see some of them. As we pay our honors to the gods of speed. As we pay our honors to the gods of light. As we pay our honors to the gods of eternal hunting success. Diana is still with us, you know. Success in the hunt. Oh, yes. The Wall Street Journal says, you know. Men who read the Wall Street Journal make it quicker than anybody. Don't think that Diana isn't still lurking out there in the bushes. And we pay the reeds and lay them down. And of course, it's all here. We're here, you know, now. You can't, you know, if you're a complete man, somebody called in a while back, says, Shepherd, you stepped out of line. You talked about something you shouldn't talk about. Oh, no. No such thing. If you're a complete man, you can't step out of line. And I am not a complete man. But there is no stepping out of line, you know, because it's all our world. All our world. And nobody has a line, really, on the world. You might have a line on your job. But my job is not to play the fool, nor the entertainer. Not really. Not really. You see, my job is to be what I am, really, in the end, which is a 20th century man, looking at his world as best he can, putting it out and looking at it and examining it. You know, you walk along and it's like this business of the Russian exposition. It was very fascinating. I enjoyed it immensely. And obviously the Russians have made tremendous strides. And their equipment was beautiful. I know something about electronic equipment. They had a lot of equipment there that was absolutely the end. And there were beautiful things like these mosaic little powder boxes and little knick-knack boxes and things. I can't describe the technique except that it's an ancient one, a kind of inlay mosaic technique. They were beautiful. And all this was there, but it was of the old world, not of the now world, you see. It was the stuff that was tradition and centuries old. And suddenly I understood, you know, what the Russian people were in this. It was very important to me. But then you see, as it gradually unfolded, you had the feeling that slowly but surely there was this development of a kind of belief beyond all beliefs, which, in a way, you see, negates the thing that man really is as he walks through time. hoping to make the best of it any time he's here, and always searching for answers, and always at one time in history feeling that he's got one, an important one that will go on and on and on, and then losing that, and then building up another one. It's been this way for as long as man has been around, you know. And you can see those old rooftops. If you look out of the L there, and you can see the Parthenon. And all the pantheon of all the gods that have long since gone, which were real, which stood there. You ready, Phil?
Ready. Now?
Yeah.
This is WOR Radio, your station for news. It's 12:30 and a half, and this is WOR AM and FM New York, owned and operated by RKO General. Ready, Gene?
Yeah. No, not really. I mean, I'm a 20th century man, which means automatically I'm not. But, you see, this is part of it, you know. This is part of the dream, always. We always figure that when the time comes, we will be ready, but we always suspect when the time comes that we will be caught with our fielder's mitt at home. Always. You know? This is quite true. We're always torn between these two things. I tell you about the guy the other day. I'm watching TV, see? And I saw a man have his most supreme moment. You know, it's wonderful when you see a person have his supreme moment of his life right before your very eyes, and I know this guy did it. He was sitting back at third base, Ed, about halfway up on the second deck there, and somebody swatted a foul ball, and it was a scorcher. This baby really, you know, he really pulled it. It was a right-handed hitter, and he pulled it. Just pulled it right over third base and right up over the dugout and up, you know, going straight up. And you could see all the people there. And the ball sailed right up in there, and suddenly right out of the crowd, this kind of short, fat guy leaped up. He must have leaped up 3 feet in the air and made a one-handed, sensational left-handed grab. Chunk! Right in the hand, and he goes down. And it was this woman, this middle-aged woman with him, you know. You could see this here. And suddenly this man was a fantastic hero beyond all heroes. And everybody hollered. Everybody hollered, yeah. I mean, they hollered. And he sat there and he rubbed that old ball up. And, you know, this guy's going to die a happy man. No, actually, he should have died then. Because you know what's going to happen now. All the rest of his life, he's going to be dogged by that dream. It's like in the middle of the crowd, you know. You see this beautiful girl that's beyond all belief, the one that you've always loved, reaches out and touches you once and then goes. And then you're never a happy man ever again. Ever. And so maybe it would have been just as well, you know, when he caught that foul ball. On the way down, you see, he died a spectacular death, but didn't drop the ball. See, the whole thing. And they would have carried him out of the park holding the ball, and there would have been this tremendous cheer, and he would have died right at the very apex of everything, you know? I remember one time, you know, if you watch carefully, you can see real life on television occasionally. And it's never sponsored by Kraft. And it's never sponsored by U.S. Steel or anything like that. I mean, it just sort of happens. And when it does happen, it's kind of a... In a way, you know, and usually it's in the middle of things that you don't expect to see real life happening. Like one time I was watching a boxing match. I don't often watch boxing. I used to some time ago. But I was watching boxing and I was on standby. This was way back in my Neanderthal days, and I was working in a television station and I was on standby. You know what is it, standby? Well, you know the voice that comes in real fast and says, WRCA-TV. That's the guy. He's on standby. And he sits there for hours. And he watches a monitor screen. And after a while, his eye is glazed. And he stops looking at the plays. And what he watches after a while, see, is when the play is going on and the hero and the heroine are getting together in this fantastic tryst in the middle of the second act, he watches the phony bookshelves on the back and watches them wiggle. You know? And he listens with his earphones to hear the sound of the camera trucks as they're dialing back and forth. And once in a while, if you listen real carefully, you can hear some cameraman swear when somebody runs over somebody's foot with a dolly. You know, and it goes on. And this is what he waits for, because this is real life. He's seen enough of the dream, you know. And it's going on and on and on. So one day I'm watching there, and I'm on standby, and this terrible match is going on, this boxing match, and I'm just sitting there dazed when I begin to realize that there's a face that I recognize in this crowd, back of third base there. Actually, it was in the first three rows, you know, the $28 seats. And I'm looking there, and I suddenly realize that there was this beautiful girl. This girl I had watched many times on the screen. And she was, you know, the plays the lovely, white, clean-limbed, beautiful-teethed heroine, you know, the kind who is always coming down out of a cloud. And there she is there, and she is there, and she is absolutely bloodthirsty. She's got big fangs hanging out. And this one guy's got the other guy against the ropes, and he's pounding, and the blood is squirting out of his ears. And she is up on her feet. And she's like that, you know, in her eyes. And I'm watching with fascination. They never mentioned she was there. I recognized her. And I sat there and watched. And then finally, the guy went down for the count, and they dragged him out. And she's hollering at him all the time when he's down. And I began to know again. It was a brief moment, a wonderful moment of real life on television. Real life. It was there. And then there was the time I saw Norm Seaburn. It was a real-life television drama. Seaburn is out there, see, and he's in the outfield, and somebody swats a fly ball. So Seaburn looks up into the sun, and I know what he was thinking. See, he looks up into the sun like that, and suddenly he lost the ball in the sun. And you saw this slight hesitation. And then he's sort of circling a little bit, and then suddenly he got his eye on it again, and he starts to run. But it was the kind of run that meant the man is defeated. See, he's running like mad, but you know that he's just going to try to play it on the bounce and make it look good. And Seaburn made a dive for it to try to smother it, and it caught. It was a fantastic catch. It caught in the webbing of his glove, and they all zoomed in on him, and his look was a look of complete disbelief. I mean, it was a look of complete disbelief. And I thought, well, by George. Me too, you know. And he's the same as that guy sitting back at third base there when they swatted the line drive up there, and he went up and he caught it. He had the same look on his face. Well, my George, you know, life is real, life is earnest, and it's also wonderful. Do I sound like Saroyan tonight or what? I mean, any minute now, you know, I'm going to talk about the lovable bums. Who are never lovable, by the way. I have never met a lovable bum. This is a terrible thing to say. I know this is almost a... I've never met a lovable bum. And I've never met a marked woman who had a heart of gold, ever. Pure tinfoil. Pure. Pure tinfoil. All the way down the line. Oh, we have with us the Paper Book Gallery. The Paper Book Gallery. And they're down there in friendly old swinging Sheridan Square. And if you're out of town. I told you this was a peculiar program tonight. If you're, you feel it? If you're out of town, you know? And, of course, the thing to do, I think most interesting thing that I've noticed about most New Yorkers is that they don't have much curiosity about their city. That have you ever walked around town and have felt that each town is part of a little map, a little circuit that somebody else travels? And you know your life travels in circuits. You know, you're working in a circuit now. I'm talking about certain streets you go on, you live, and you're part of certain places you go that are totally different from the circuit that you traveled, say, 5 years ago or 2 years ago. And when you leave one circuit, you seem to leave it irrevocably. You know that? You never go back. And once in a while you go back, and you hardly even remember that this was very important once. That all these little cleaning shops in these places you went were part, so much part of the integral life radius that you traveled. And now suddenly it's gone, forgotten. And you move into these areas, you move into these different circuits almost so gradually that it's that you don't know you're doing it. And one day you know that you're in a certain situation that was totally different from one that you had 4 years ago. It just happened. And you walk along the city, you know, and it gets to the point where the city is so bittersweet with memories of one kind or another that sometimes you can hardly bear to go to certain places, certain areas, if you really have been part of the city. And I know that many people who live in New York are not part of New York, interestingly enough. They're living in a little apartment up on the Grand Concourse, and they're this, you know, and that's it. But this is not really it. And if you're part of Manhattan, that's all I can say, if you're part of the growing, swinging Manhattan scene, that there are certain areas that in the end become impossible for you to go to because of the poignancy involved. And it doesn't take long. It only takes a few years, if you're living in this place, to develop that. I have a friend, for example, who has lived most of his life, but New York to him is always a wonder. He has retained the outlook of the artist on New York, and it is just a thing he can't stay away from. And there are whole areas of New York he just can't get himself to go to anymore. Because it's like suddenly walking through your past. And really walking through your past. And many parts of your past are often in the future of the past, let us say, in retrospect, are often quite painful. Painful in a different way, though. I don't mean real pain. I mean a kind of a bittersweet pain that is very definite. It's like going back home again. You can't do it, you know. And New York is millions of homes. And I don't mean apartments. I mean homes, the whole radius around a central place. And you walk, and you see, and you feel, and then you can't go back. Once the change has happened, it is there. And I remember walking through it, and this is kind of an odd thing. I remember going through Pompeii, of all places, the ruins. And sure, the ruins are interesting. But the thing that always haunted me was the fact that there were circuits there. That undoubtedly you could almost feel the people still there. And when you walked along certain streets more than others here in New York, particularly on the east side, not so much on the west side, but on the east side, because the east side is more the area of the change and transition. People come and go. The west side is, interestingly enough, much more of a home side. So you don't find that, really. But you go on the east side, particularly in the more gold-plated areas, and the ground is encrusted with it. The trees are encrusted with it. With these areas, these memories, these people things that are left behind. But do you feel what I'm talking about? and you walk along a street, and it means nothing to you, but you know the street. There are a lot of people who can't come here without feeling something, because you know that you have streets that you can't go near without feeling it, without feeling whatever that is. We have the paperback gallery with us here. And what I ought to do is do this cheese commercial.
And the tape flops off the old reel-to-reel. I wish there were more.